was like, okay, I have to figure this out. I have to think in my own head. And I think I actually upset my mom because we came home and I just wanted to go up to our room. Like, I didn't want to sit downstairs. I didn't want to talk. I just wanted to, you know, go be by myself and think. And I know that she was actually hurt by that, but, you know.
It's hard. It's hard.
Yeah.
Okay, if we get more people that are coming on and on. But it is very hard. God, we've got like a million topics to talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very hard for loved ones to kind of go with the flow of what the patient is going through.
Yeah.
Well, when I'm sick, I don't like to be babied. But at the other hand, when I'm really, really in a bad way, I need somebody there just in case.
Yes, yes. That is actually one of my topics that I will be definitely covering in the coming months and probably sooner rather than later is, you know, that support system and, you know, figuring out what you need from them and what they need from you, too, because it goes both ways.
It really does because, you know, it's not – I don't consider my husband necessarily a caregiver to me.
Right.
I don't like to think of that because I don't like to think of myself as a sick person. I know.
Right.
And that's why I try to push myself, which is probably something that I would not advocate for a lot of people. It's just how I've worked my life.
Yeah, exactly. But
myself, I know that there's going to be a consequence, like that conference. I knew there was a consequence for that, but it's worth it. And it's balancing the risks. If I do this, I know it's going to set me back this much time, maybe longer. Is it so valuable, has so much meaning that it's worth doing? Nine times out of 10 it is. And, no, 10 times out of 10.
Yeah.
To start the program officially, it's 11:02. I'm sure we're going to have some more people that are coming on. I'd like to welcome all of you here today. I'm so glad that you were able to come to our sewer obstruction program. I don't know if that's good or bad. It's bad because you need to be here because sewer obstruction is a part of your life. But it's so great that we have such a community of patients who really understand what is having different types of motility disorders, such as pseudo-obstruction. Those who don't know me, my name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. In 1991, I had the privilege of starting this Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders. We are now going into our 26th of service, and that's another good thing, bad thing. Good thing is that for 26 years, we've been able to reach out and help many people. Bad that many people need help. Pseudo-obstruction, it's kind of like a lost motility disorder in that gastroparesis is getting more and more legs, if you will, of people understanding and knowing and researching it. And gastroparesis, people are going, oh, yeah, just like irritable bowel. Oh, you have irritable bowel. So much research going on with irritable bowel. It's amazing. They even have a blood test now to determine it, all different types of breath tests. It's just phenomenal. But with pseudo-obstruction, it still is one of those motility disorders that really lies shadow. Do know there is genetic testing going on for that. There's more testing being done in Europe, Australia, and I believe in Canada, but not so much in the United States. And it's kind of a disjointed problem because there isn't a comprehensive way of diagnosing it that every institution does. And thus it takes many patients a long time before they're diagnosed. In my case, it took 5 years. And it was a very dire type of a diagnosis. For 5 years, I didn't know what I had. Very scary. What is going on? I was losing weight. I couldn't eat. I was in extreme pain. My belly was swollen. Vomiting. I would give my one enema, the big water enemas. The water wouldn't come out. I'd give myself another one in the same sitting. that one come out. I give myself up to 4 enemas and the water wouldn't come out, and then I'd have to sit on the toilet and just with my hands kind of knead my belly to get little drops of water out. That's how bad it was and is to this day. So after those 5 years, when I got to the doctor and the doctor said, I think you have a motility problem. We need to do further tests. And when it was finally diagnosed as chronic idiopathic intestinal food obstruction, it was a very big turning point in my life because it finally had a name. And that was the good news. But the bad news was, years ago, I was 1 in 6 in this part of the United States diagnosed with this. So there was really no support system.
Mary Angela,
yes.
This is Adama. I have a question. I want to make sure. Is this, when does the gastroparesis group start? What is the one you're in now?
That's at 12:30. This is pseudo obstruction one. So I think you're in the wrong one.
Yeah, no. But I didn't know which one was which. Sorry. Okay. Thanks.
No problem. At that time, the surgeons wanted to remove part of my intestinal tract. I was down to 69 pounds. I didn't think that I would be able to live through the surgery. Plus, I would ask the doctors, if they remove part of my intestines, would it guarantee that I'd be cured and much better? And they didn't have any answer. I asked, what caused this? They didn't have any answer. I asked, if you remove this, would it potentially still progress to other the digestive tract, and they didn't have an answer. So I opted not to do that. The doctor was not very happy with me and that I needed to see a psychiatrist. So now I have this big named illness and didn't know what to do with it. And it was a very challenging time in my life, and I've heard from so many people that it oftentimes takes a long time before you're diagnosed, and then once you're diagnosed, it's kind of a mixed feeling. You go, wow, it finally has a name, but now what do you do with it? So I'm going to reach out to all of you. The only thing that I ask is every time you talk, if you can say your first name so that we can match the voice with whoever's talking. If you don't have a first name, you can make up a name, somebody who you've always wanted to be. And the other thing is, please not give your contact information or ask anybody else contact information during the program. If you're interested in communicating with anybody else, then you can certainly reach out to us and we'll see if they're interested in communicating. So on that note, you can either respond to something I've said about how long it takes and how you finally got that diagnosis, or you can tell us what brought you here today and pose any questions or concerns. It's a safe place where people understand. So feel free to jump in. Anybody want to start?
How about me, Mary Angelica? My name is Phyllis. I live in Vienna, Virginia. My son, who is 39, he had a stroke during labor and delivery. So we've been fighting for him a long time. He's accomplished a great deal in his life. The last 5 years have been a horror show, including a massive tumor removed from his brain, benign and one growing at this point. He has not been able to eat. He's been in excruciating pain. We've been to Johns Hopkins. I have never met any group of people as rude as they can be if you have a disability. We've been to Georgetown. We've been to every doctor in the metropolitan area, many hospitals, hospitals that have said to me, your son is intellectually challenged. He has no idea what he feels or what he's talking about. My son happens to be very bright. Yeah, very bright, became an Eagle Scout, held a job at the Department of Commerce for 15 years. He has accomplished many things. Last 5 years have been a total horror show. We were in the hospital again on Sunday. Again, everything came out fine, screaming and yelling in pain. Has not been able to eat for 18 months. I have scleroderma. of the entire digestive system. I've been telling the doctors he had scleroderma. We've been, his blood work's been sent 3 times to the Mayo Clinic. Last spring was the 3rd time. He comes out autoimmune without the word scleroderma. But anyway, yesterday, colon rectal surgeon, it's only the 2nd time we've been to him, put everything together and came out with this pseudo obstruction, which makes perfect sense to me with my scleroderma. Mm-hmm. Pain is excruciating. He's been on narcotics until a month ago for 2 years. Every narcotic known to man, anything a drug dealer would want, we have in the house. So now here we are. We have the diagnosis. Now where do I go? He's lost 20 pounds. He can barely eat. He'd like to get his life back. There's just he and I. I'm a single mother. Our support has been a few neighbors in our neighborhood who have stuck with us. My family has absolutely turned their back on us, including an older son. But here I am. You know, we're not giving up. We fought a long time. I fought for him since he was born. But now what do I do? You know, how do we control the pain? What do we eat? He is going to have on Friday a vent put in mm-hmm. by our GI to see if we can, I guess, control some of the gas. But, yeah, you know, I feel like somebody just hit me in the stomach. So how do I get forward with him to prepare him for a life to fight this alone? And, you know, I'm so glad I found Mary Angelica. Anybody that can help me, I would really appreciate it.
Hi, Phyllis. This is Laura. Yeah. Just a quick note. If he's getting a vent, which is a pretty much a gastric tube, they do them in they make a double that is a vent for the stomach, but then you can feed through the intestine. So he doesn't have to eat food for a while. He could, you know, have like a formula to get him back to health. It works for
you know,
me.
Laura,
they're called J2s.
You know, Laura, when he was 14, he almost passed away. I actually saved him with an EpiPen. Found out he had no ability to swallow anymore. He was on G-tubes until 19. Another GI entered and said he wanted a J-tube. It never worked because he's constantly refluxing mm-hmm. out the hole. Then it took us 2 years with our 7th swallowing therapist to retrain him to swallow. So what we've been doing is, you know, very soft foods. He said to me, I would rather die than ever be fed with the G-tube again. I will respect his wishes. So we plan for just the vent.
Sorry, I don't want to cut in here, but my name is Brittany. Phyllis, I have had pseudo-obstruction since birth. And your son's battle is just absolutely heartbreaking to me, and unfortunately, in many ways, mirrors mine. I went through many, many years where I didn't have a GI doctor because they were all afraid of me. they couldn't cure me, they couldn't do anything for me, so they didn't want to deal with me. I wish I had words to say that, you know, everything's going to be great, but I can't say that. But I do want you to know, and I don't know if you can convey this to your son, but you guys are not alone. You have support more than you can even imagine within this group. Mary Angela, Laura, myself, and anybody else that you come in contact with this group, will support you to the best of our abilities. Mary Angela has unbelievable amounts of information as far as doctors that you might be able to, you know, contact. I've actually, you aren't the first person that I've heard of that has not had great things to say about Johns Hopkins. I personally have not been there, so I can't tell you. I'm in the Midwest, so I deal with Chicago doctors, but I've talked to somebody else too who said that Johns Hopkins doctors and Georgetown doctors weren't able to help them. I have also been in your son's place where I've said to my mom that I would rather die than have, you know, another tube placed, another this done, another that done. Is your son nutritionally sound at the moment, or is he, you know, getting to that point where he's, you know, not, I guess, you know, starting to failure to thrive, if that's, you know, probably not the best term, but...
I have found a dietitian here. I haven't used her yet.
Okay.
She doesn't take insurance or anything. But the doctor yesterday is going to have someone call me, and they didn't call me last night, a new product he has found that he wants to try Philip on. I have lived on InsurePlus for 20 years and eaten very little.
Mm-hmm.
Now at my age, my sugar's gone up. Now I'm living on Glucerna.
Okay.
So I got Philip on Glucerna because he found Boost was just too heavy. But
yeah.
Someone's going to be calling me with some new product on the market. We also have found another product called, is it called ProNourish? Just came into our stores. It's advertised on TV.
Mm-hmm.
He was supposed to go for a blood test yesterday to see what his numbers are as far as being malnourished. Now, this guy's big. He's 6'5".
Oh, wow.
And I'm almost 6 feet, so he's a big guy, but I mean very, very thin. You know, he's lost 20 pounds.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's in the category of being malnourished yet, but we're trying to find out.
Okay.
We're trying to find out.
Nutrition is so important. I remember that a dietitian had recommended in one of the programs something called, I think I'm going by my brain now, Vitamix, and some people have tried that and found that to be easy to digest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that would be another option. And then, of course, there's baby food as well. It comes in small quantities, and you can kind of like nurse it throughout the day, whatever you're eating. But that nutrition is critical. And even if some of the electrolytes are off, that's going to affect him. Is there anybody on who is taking anything for the pain of pseudo-obstruction? No.
Well, I'll jump in again. If anybody else wants to jump in, please do. Just shut me up. It's real easy to do. Okay, well, maybe it's not that easy to do. But, you know, I will shut up for you. I, too, deal with constant chronic pain. I would say on a daily basis, I wake up at a 5, and I am never really lower than that. And it gets up to, you know, a pain of 8, 9, you know, I know that the whole pain scale, well, 10 is if you're in the hospital. Well, okay, well, if I go to the hospital, they aren't going to do anything for me. I'd rather be in pain in my own bed than waiting in a ER waiting room with that pain. So, but I deal with horrible, horrible pain too. I'm on narcotics currently. I do see a pain management specialist. I don't know if your son has seen someone like that.
Actually, I've been going for 2 years, and they're the ones that have been, prescribing. Also, he's been prescribed tremendous amounts of, he was on Neurontin. He can't take that anymore.
Okay.
But right now, because he's just gotten out of George Washington University Hospital with seizures, only they proved that they weren't brain seizures from the removal of the brain tumor and the little one growing. He has seizures, I forget the name, neuro something, which means it's the stress on the body. He wakes up inside like you do. The minute he eats those scrambled eggs, he's in 10.
Yeah.
Last night, this is a typical night, he screams from 7 o'clock at night until he finally goes to sleep at 1. And the only thing I can give him now is when he goes to bed, he can have 10 milligrams of Valium during the day if it's just out of control. And he always says to me, I'm not saying 10. My pain is 500.
Yeah.
You know, I can give him a Valium during the day. But, you know, it really doesn't touch anything. And the interesting thing is, no matter how many narcotics they gave Philip over the last 2 years, it didn't touch the pain.
Yeah. Have you, and I do understand, I'm on disability, so money issues and insurance issues, I definitely understand. But has, I don't know if he can tolerate it, but can you do anything like massage?
You know, that's interesting. We went to have a massage. He went crazy. And we have a new neurologist who I really like at GW. He used to be the medical director of the Northern Virginia Training Center, where it's like 50 years old. If a baby was born and nobody wanted it, they'd stick him in this institution. He was the director for 25 years. He's now got his own private practice at George Washington University. And he said to me, Phyllis, he has no feeling in the whole left quadrant area. So when they did a massage a couple years ago, he went crazy. It must have had something to do. He's very tactile sensitive, you know, because he already has brain damage.
Right.
He doesn't want anyone to touch him.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I get so bad, I can massage my stomach.
Yeah.
He doesn't want anyone to touch him.
Okay.
But
I don't know
if does your narcotic actually work?
sometimes. Okay, this I've found that it keeps me at a functioning level unless I am in a this is what's ironic about it. If I am in a real bad pain, you know, episode, you know, from eating or from whatever, my pain medication doesn't work at all then.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it could be kind of the same thing with your son. I don't want to jump the gun here either, but, you know, obviously nutrition is a big thing. And nutrition not only affects the body, but it also affects the brain and affects how he, you know, feels, you know, as far as emotionally. And I know I've suffered with depression for many years, as well as anxiety and things like that. And like I said, I would never want to jump the gun with this, but has things like TPN been brought up to keep him nutritionally sound?
I brought this up to the colorectal surgeon yesterday. I said, do we go for a bowel transplant? I said, do we do TPN? What are we going to do? He said, I'm not ready to get to that point yet.
Okay.
So, you know, the other thing is he's insisting on eating, and yet he knows he's going to be screaming in pain. So I give him a little bit of scrambled eggs. I mean, he can do that himself. It's always a challenge to see, but there are very few things he can eat. You know, what do I have in the house? I've been pureeing his food for years because of his esophageal dysfunction.
If I could interject, this is Kevin.
Oh, sure.
I'm a first-time caller, actually, to this program.
So
but yeah, right. I've got pseudo-obstruction. I've had it for about 3 years now, and I've been through, I'm actually from Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I've been through the local doctors here, ended up going to Cleveland Clinic for about 3 to 4 months for a to review a intestinal transplant. And long story short there is I was approved, I was put on the transplant list, but when my wife and I were there, we went through what they call a dry run where we were brought into the hospital for the transplant, and we ended up finding out some things that we really didn't care for, and in the long run, they didn't do the transplant for me anyway because the organ was disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm.
But we chose to go against doing a bowel transplant only because it's pretty rare yet. There's a lot of a lot of risk with it. I'm actually on TPN 10 hours a day, every day, and I'm continuing to work. I work every day. I don't have any pain issues unless I try and eat something, but if I do eat anything, it's a little bite of a cookie or cracker here or there just to get a taste of food, but I can't physically eat any food, so I'm on TPN during the day, and I feel good. I just don't quite have the energy levels I used to, but TPN has been a godsend for me. It is a pain in the rear to do, but once you get used to it, you get in a lifestyle, it might be something worth considering.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I, too, Phyllis, have been on TPN. I've been on it all but 6 years of my life. I was off from age 19 to 25, and I'll be 32 in April. So I've been on TPN for that long. And I, too, have been, you know, I've done my own research as far as transplant goes, and that will be a, for me, again, that is a personal choice for everybody, but for me, that will be a last and final resort for me, if I even want to consider that as a last and final resort. But TPN is definitely an option at some point, and I have a great life with it.
Yeah, TPN, I know a lot of people are afraid of it, and thank you all for your input on this. A lot of people are afraid of it, and afraid of infection process. It can be overwhelming, but it can be a lifeline, and there's an organization called the Olie Foundation, which our whole organization revolves around enteral feeding, tubal feeding, all of these types. And they give so much support, and they have a lot of great programs. So it really is helpful on that. The other thing is, I know perhaps many of you, but in my own case, as the journey was beginning, it wasn't unusual, even though I knew that food would give me pain. It's human nature to want to eat. It's like somebody on a diet, all of a sudden they cheat. But with us, we get the pain when we eat certain things, and it doesn't have rhyme or reason. You can eat one thing one day, and then the next day, you can eat the same thing and be on your knees in pain. But I think that human nature says that you're on this earth, you eat, and there's that impulse and temptation to put something in your mouth that's crunchy or hot or liquid, you know, whatever it may be. And it wasn't until the acceptance of my illness, and that more times than not, that trumped any that it was getting, that I eventually stopped. And with many of us with food obstruction who aren't on tubal feeding, our repertoire gets smaller and smaller of what we call our safe foods, even though it's quite safe.
You know, this is George from
George,
California, and I just want to talk about the pain a little bit. I'm 64, and I have SIPO, not as bad as any of you people, but my son has it very severe. He's 30, and he had it since age 14 or so. And his pain, and I took him to all kinds of doctors, and I did a lot of tests on him myself because I'm a family physician, but none of the doctors could ever figure out his pain. And as his SIPO progressively got increased, I mean, he had the pain where he couldn't walk. He couldn't walk. His pain was so bad. I mean, I had to take him around in a wheelchair, and the doctors all looked at me as if I'm crazy. I said, what else can I do? I don't know what else to do. I did all kinds of different tests to try to figure out the source of the pain. And finally, last year, or December of 2015, because he kept losing weight and he was very sick in and out of the hospital, and they, he finally had a J-tube placed, and immediately after that started, after the initial operation, his pain went like 90% away. So the reason for his pain, and for most people's pain when it comes to GI stuff, is with distension. You could cut your intestine with a knife, you wouldn't feel it, or your stomach, but if you distend it with air or food, the pain is unreal. I myself was in the hospital last week with a small bowel obstruction that just lasted a couple of days because I went in really early, and so I said, put that NG tube down and let's get started here, and I was pretty lucky. But I've had it other times where I was in the hospital for 11 days due to aspiration. So that pain is from that distension. And the narcotics, which, you know, they give you in acute cases, the problems with the narcotics, it slows down the gut further. So there's more stasis, more bacterial overgrowth, more gas, more distension. So that does not really a good long-term solution, unfortunately. And then Andrew now, if he doesn't eat, eat any little thing, he's in pain again. I mean, he does cheat here and there once in a while, but for the most part, it just gives him more grief than what it's worth. It's, I mean, he suffers mentally because of it and socially, but I admire him because I don't even know if I could do that, you know? We're Italian and, you know, food has always been the priority. So, so that distension is what causes so much pain, and that's what you have to try some way, somehow eliminate. And the way your son sounds, I mean, he sounds really very, very serious, especially if the underlying cause is scleroderma or autoimmune. Even if he had an intestinal transplant, and it might work for 6 months, and then whatever the underlying cause is, will attack the new organs, and you're still up with the same condition. So it's a very, very difficult situation to treat. So I agree with some of the others. He may need to have TPN as a last resort. I had a cousin who had SIPO really bad, and he was one of the earliest patients put on TPN in the 1970s. He was on it for about 20, 30 years, kept him alive. And it's a different lifestyle, but sometimes you just don't have a choice.
And does your son have a vent that they put in?
No, he doesn't have a vent. He does not have them. He just has a jejunostomy. They wanted to put in a vent with a tube from, this was the specialist, mind you, with a tube going from the stomach to the jejunum. But sometimes those tubes come out, and he just had the jejunostomy feeding tube, and really it has worked. He looks great. You look at him, he looks wonderful, and he's really not in pain, at least physical. Mentally, he's in a lot of pain, but physical, he's really not for the most part, unless he eats a little something he's not supposed to. He'll have little sips or something, but really he could never get in enough nutrition with any kind of liquid. Even liquids would distend him, and he would vomit, I'm telling you, like a half a gallon of liquid, of vomitus at the time. He'd get so dehydrated, and it was constant running back and forth to the hospital trying to get him rehydrated. So he did not. So I said, well, I knew from previous studies that his main problem was his stomach and maybe this first portion of the duodenum. And then, so I knew once that barium got to the jejunum, it'd go right through him. So I said, just put the tube in the jejunum and let's see how it goes. And knock wood, so far it's been okay. It's been about a little over a year.
Did anyone go to the Mayo Clinic, to the digestive disease department?
No,
we haven't. No.
Okay.
But again, everything's different. So somebody may go and have a wonderful experience, and another person may go and see that same doctor and not have such an experience.
Correct.
You have to find the team that is going to work for you and your son.
And also a doctor and a team who shares the same goals that you have, because a lot of doctors are just like, okay, you know, getting the most years out of the patient, when if that patient's life is, you know, not quality, that's not necessarily a good thing. You know, it all depends on the patient. I work with my doctors so that my quality of life is top priority.
Right, that's a good point.
I mean, I don't know your name, but you said your son was Andrew, you're a doctor. My main thing has been that I am the manager. I cannot get a group of doctors to work with me on a cohesive basis. So I go from doctor to doctor. Nobody talks to anybody. I'm conveying information, bringing reports. You know, I feel like that hamster in a cage.
Yeah, right. and unfortunately, you have to keep doing that because you're his advocate. I do the same for my son, and you know, they give me a little more respect because I'm a physician, and sometimes I don't disagree with what they say, even though I'm not a specialist in the area. But they don't have the answers, unfortunately. You know, I'm the one who maybe suggests trying this medication or that medication, and let's try it. But
and Phyllis, my mom was. My mom was in the same place that you are. You know, she was my caregiver for, until I was able to take care of my own stuff, when I was old enough. But she was the same way. And this was, this was 30 years ago where there wasn't the internet. There wasn't any, not to sound like I'm, ancient or anything, but, you didn't have the resources that luckily we do have now with AGMD and, the internet and things like that. I don't have a cohesive team. I have select doctors that I have literally handpicked, and I have had my fair share of doctors where I've met them, I've talked, with them, and if they seem, if they aren't going to value the quality of life that I am looking for, then I find somebody else. Unfortunately, it's a lot of trial and error, but I have different doctors at different hospitals that I go to for different things, and they don't always talk to each other, but that has worked for me. Now, everybody is different, and you may want that cohesive team that talks to each other and things like that, and, maybe Mary Angela has some contacts that, she can, guide you with, but, I just want to reiterate the first thing that I said is that you aren't alone in this and that you do have support and your son has support with us. And my heart breaks for you guys. It really does, especially, with you dealing with, your own health issues, too, on top of it. I mean, I can't imagine. But, I've tried J-tube feedings. I've tried G-tube feedings. And I am similar to your son where I would just give it all back. So tube feedings are not an option for me, which is why I am now on TPN.
Just to add, and please, if anybody else wants to jump in with a different subject, and it's a pseudo-obstruction, please just say your name and then we'll get you in. But in when you are approaching a doctor, and especially a new doctor, it's really important to be very organized for that appointment. So it's not just making the appointment, calling up, getting your insurance stuff, and then leaving for the appointment, but it's planning out. What I typically do is I have a sheet that has, even though they have records, doesn't matter. It's like a little capsule form of, these are the tests I've had, these are the results, these are my diseases, these are my allergies, my surgeries, family history.
Well, you'll be interested. I go with this huge suitcase. I keep all records, all x-rays, and all history. They just say one thing, I open it up and hand it to them. I have learned in turn for him for 39 years, you just have to always be on top of the game. Always on top of the most, So I've learned to do that.
And I bring in with questions, but feel free to write down the answers to those questions. And if you don't understand what the doctor is saying, to ask that doctor to repeat it a different way. And if you're still not comprehending or you think you sort of get it, then put in your words, am I to understand this is what you're saying? The other thing that I do with all doctors, because I just saw a specialist in December. Before, as they're looking at all the stuff there, I always say, I have a very complex case. There's no cure for what I have. Are you willing to take me on as a patient? And sometimes, like the one I just saw, said, I'm really not so sure.
Yep.
I want to take the patient, and at least you know where you stand. Others will say, absolutely, and will even... Doctors who you may have seen for years once they get to that point where they doctors are taught to heal and help, and when they can no longer, your illness is beyond the scope of their abilities at that particular point, then they may change towards you as well.
Yeah.
All part of the process. I don't know if anybody's experienced that, but
yeah, I did. I just recently changed my GI doctor. I had seen him for over a decade, and he got to the point where he, you know, had kind of run out of ideas for me, and so I started seeing somebody else. I went with the same group, but with a different doctor who may have been doing different research.
Good. And that's what we call hope. And that is that hopeful, so you don't give up and you don't give in, and you keep on marching until you find that right doctor who, as limited as they're going to be in the realm of pseudo-obstruction at this point, doesn't mean that they're not doing research and that they're not going to find more information on it. As I said before, they're doing genetic studies on it. And George, I'd like you to talk a little more about that if you could.
Sure.
George, can you tell us about the two studies that you've been involved with?
Yes. You know, there's one study at Columbia University under Dr. Piccarallo, and it's under the, I think, Wendy Chang is her name. And this is a national study. I think they received a grant from the federal government where they want to get 1 million patients with rare genetic disorders and analyze their genes. So my son and I, we both participated in that one. And actually, they looked at it for over a year and a half, and they can't find anything wrong, unfortunately, because there was a particular gene that controls the growth of muscle within the small intestine. They call it, I think, actinomycin 2 gene or something. Anyhow, there was a Finnish family that had that, and they also had the SIPO. So we were tested for that, but we didn't have it. But they are looking for families with it. So with scleroderma, you know, you might contact them, and they you know, it's going to help for the future. It's not going to help you personally,
yeah,
probably, but we have to contribute as much as we can because there are so few of us to do research to understand the underlying genetics, and then maybe something can be done to alter the genes or stem cell or who knows what will be coming up in the future. The other study is being done by Dr. Malunsky in Massachusetts, and he's a geneticist, and he's working with Yale University, and they are also doing a study on SIPO patients. So Mary Angela can give you that information if you'd like to contact him to see if you qualify. And it's very simple. You go to your doctor's office and just take a couple tubes of a purple top tube, a CBC tube, and just send it in the mail to them. It's not like you have to do anything so special. But anything that we can do, I think, to contribute to the research, because they need the patients, and there's so few of us, and to do any, you know, you can't do these randomly controlled double-blind studies because it's we don't have enough patients to do it. But I think if we get to the basic science, to the actual genetics of it, and it will be varied because there's so many different forms of SIPO. Some are genetic and some are just spontaneous mutations and some with these autoimmune-related diseases. But you don't know where it's going to lead and who will come up with an answer. And it takes time, but I think if we all contribute our bodies, our blood, it might help. So I would definitely encourage that to all listeners here today.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so the still going on, George, I just want to be sure on that because I haven't heard – from Dr.
Who? Malunsky? Oh, Dr.
What the heck is it? Piccarello.
Yeah. Piccarello, yeah.
Yeah, Piccarello.
Is that one still going on?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
What they do is they analyze the whole genome, and then they try to see where there's abnormalities. But usually they need a couple family members.
And now,
our whole family actually contributed blood. Only two, my wife and daughter didn't have anything, but my son and I are the ones. And I definitely have a genetic condition. I have familial form of it because I have met multiple cousins with the same disease. So, that's the other thing. You have to ask family members if they have anything like this. And people, sometimes they don't like to talk about their medical histories.
Right. Can I ask a quick question on that?
Sure.
I know you said that. Do you have pseudo-obstruction?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So, okay, because, like, I have a weird family history. My father, unfortunately, passed away a couple of years ago, so I can't ask him for anything.
What did he die from?
He died from Agent Orange-related illness.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And we actually have very strong suspicions that that could be where my pseudo-obstruction comes from.
Could be.
My mom doesn't have pseudo-obstruction, but she does have digestive illnesses. She has chronic constipation, and she does have a bit of Crohn's. So I didn't know if I would qualify for that because of,
you might email and just ask them, you know. It almost sounds, in your case, because who knows, Agent Orange was like a neurotoxin, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, it did all kinds of things. So who, and it affected the offspring, I believe, too. I mean,
yeah, and my dad had a son after he came back from Vietnam who passed away from a lymphosarcoma. And he had a daughter before he went to Vietnam who is fine medically. Both his son and then me have issues.
Yeah.
So we've always kind of suspected that it's more Agent Orange, but I would be curious to know if it is genetic because I do have, nieces and nephews, and I always wanted to know, you know, if there was a genetic component to this. Sorry, not to me. Obviously, there's genetic components to me, but.
Yeah, if I could interject, this is Kevin again. My father was actually diagnosed with pseudo obstruction back in 1979, and he died in 1994 from liver failure, which was a result of numerous years on TPN. But he actually had the same exact diagnosis as I have, which is pseudo-obstruction. So that leads me to believe there is something genetically, going on. And furthermore, I have two sons, and, my wife and I are thinking, well, are they going to be predisposed to, to this issue down the road? So we'd be very interested in any kind of genetic studies or tests that could be done in order to try and define this more.
Send me an email, and then what I will do is I will get in touch with the Columbia study, and then I will give you the information on that so that you'll be able to participate.
Very good. Thank you.
And a side note, Mary Angela, I did get a response from Dr. Malinowski from the other one,
from the other
genetic study. Yeah. Sorry, I totally just butchered his last
Malinowski.
Name. I really apologize.
Malinowski.
Yes. Yeah, so he of course called me as I was in my doctor's appointment yesterday, but I'll be calling him back today. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, he's an interesting fellow. Yeah, he's interesting.
He is. He's a very interesting fellow. He's brilliant. So
this is Phyllis, and I come from a long line, all Irish, of very different autoimmune diseases.
Yeah.
Very different.
But, my feeling that there's a good many number of patients with SIPO can be autoimmune, and the autoimmune system can be where it attacks either the neurons, the nerves, or it's attacking the muscle tissue itself. And for whatever reason, unfortunately, we just don't have that antibody or to figure it out why. Of course, the scleroderma, again, there's a lot of autoimmunity with that. And I know myself with MS, I also have MS. Although none of the families really has it. So the autoimmune system is totally strange. And some people can present with benign stuff like eczema or asthma or these other horrible diseases. And with the SIPO business, even people who sometimes – just catch a terrible viral infection, an infectious type of diarrhea, it triggers them off, where it damages the neurologic tissue. So there's a lot of underlying reasons to get it. So that's why it's always important that you can find out.
Also, Philip really started this after he had C. diff for 10 months.
Mm.
And we were about to have a transplant over at Johns Hopkins when a new infectious disease doctor put him on something called Difsid. It was gone in 2 weeks after 10 months. I often wonder if that didn't set this off.
Yeah, you hear a lot of stories like that with even this doctor out here in Dr. Pimentel. I mean, he did a big study in Canada where, I mean, it wasn't so much SIPO, but these healthy people in this community got some kind of viral gastroenteritis, and then after a while, like 50% of them, a very high number, developed irritable bowel syndrome that they never had before. Again, that's irritable bowel syndrome is, you know, a relatively benign form of, you know, I would say SIPO, but you know, you have constipation, diarrhea, pain, bloating, but disabling to many patients because it can be so bad. But it just goes to show there's other underlying reasons that are involved with the function, the motility of the gastrointestinal tract.
Right. Has anyone tried NIH? I just called them and called the digestive department and left my name and asked them to call me back.
No.
I've seen their website. This is George again. I've seen their website, and, you know, I asked about SIPO, and they give you all the standard, you know, stuff, not anything new or recent. So, but, yeah, it's good to try. I say it's good to try. You never know. They might have something new now.
Yeah. I'm kind of stubborn. I stay close to home because I won't travel, you know, far away when I, you know, can't come back home and, you know, my other half, you know, has to work. So, and I refuse to be in hospitals alone. So I just stay close to home. But I know if you, you know, are able to travel and do things like that to explore other hospitals is, you know, something that is definitely an option.
Yeah, I think also another thing is that what I hear from pseudo-obstruction patients, and I know with myself and I know with George, that the bladder can be involved as well.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if all of you have that problem or some of you, but that can be a key in some of the symptoms as well. So just for those who aren't familiar with it or don't have it, doesn't mean you're going to get it. It just means that that could be one of the symptoms as well.
Well, Philip has his first UTI infection. Does that have anything to do with this?
It could. He should have probably a bladder ultrasound to make sure he's not retaining urine. I mean, that was my initial presentation was with a huge bladder. My bladder was up to my xiphoid, and go to urologist and say, "Oh, you're having a large prostate," but it wasn't that at all. It was due to the pseudo obstruction, because for some reason it affects the bladder neck, and you lose sensation. You don't really even realize how bad you're doing over the years. But yes, it can definitely have, you know, urinary retention. How old is your son, Philip?
He's 39.
Yeah, so.
Just turned 39.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's less likely for prostate, but he should definitely be checked. Just a simple, after the post-void ultrasound of the bladder urinates, and then they do a bladder ultrasound to make sure he's not retaining urine. Simple, non-invasive test to do, and that'll kind of give you an idea. Either a urologist or the regular doctor could actually just order the test. It's not like some doctors do it in their office or you have to go to a radiologic facility. That's a simple thing to do and worthwhile doing too. The other thing I'm just going to throw out, I don't know if it would help him at all, is the drug prucalopride, which is like a promotility agent.
It's
from Canada. And it does have some motility.
George, I think it just moved around here. I'm going to double check on that.
Are you talking about domperidone?
No. Prucalopride, Resolor.
Is that also known as Gattex?
I'm not sure about that. Different names in different countries, but it's from Canada. It really comes from England. It's a 5-hydroxytryptamine-4 stimulant. So. It does. I took one the other day myself because I was so bloated, but it does give you a lot of cramping. You may have to adjust the dose. But it does help for the lower intestine for sure. It's mostly designed for women with constipation, so it does help lower intestinal tract, but it can also sometimes work on the upper gastrointestinal tract.
And how
do you spell
something
to consider.
And how do you spell that?
It is spelled P RUCALOPRIDE.
You can find it on the internet.
It's also, there's another word, there's another name for it. I don't know if it's the brand name, but it's also called Resolor, R-E-S-O-L-O-R.
Yes, that's the brand name.
Yeah.
R-E-S-O-L-O-R.
A-R.
And can you get it here, or do I have to get it here?
No, you have to get it from Canada. Canada RF. Your physician can prescribe it if they will. Sometimes they won't do it.
Actually, I think it is approved here now.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought, now I'm trying to find the whole thing on it.
I am
too. I'm able to pull that up. But I think, I'm pretty sure that it just recently got approved, and it got approved with a different name, too. So hang tight for a second.
Oh, that would be good.
Yeah. But you can keep talking. I'll just jump in when I find
it. You know, all these drugs, they sometimes work for a while. I know when my son was younger and the doctors didn't prescribe when he was 13, 14, and I prescribed a drug called Zelnorm, which at that time was for women with constipation, and helped him for a good couple of years. Then they took it off the market, and he was doing better. And then, of course, the disease progressed, and like when I was giving him the prucalopride now these last couple of years, it helped a little bit, but not enough to prevent him from getting J-tube. So.
Can I don't know if any of you know this, because obviously pseudo-obstruction can progress as you get older, and in my case, it certainly has. But can you develop bladder issues as you go? Or is that something that more than likely would have showed up from the beginning?
No, you can, because I see that in my own family history. I have four brothers and a sister, and three of us have bladder issues. I have a younger brother who has a bladder retention, and an older brother but he's older than me, but developed much later in life, in his 60s. Doesn't have too much of the GI stuff, so it can develop, so you always have to be aware of it. You know, if you feel like you're bloating up down there, just get a post-void ultrasound, and they can kind of keep an eye on that. If it's less than 50 cc's, you don't have anything, but you can develop it, yes.
Yeah. Well, I've had pseudo obstruction since birth. I don't have a colon. I have 17% of my small bowel is gone now. I have an ileostomy, and I've never had issues with bladder problems at all. But as of within the last 6 months, I've noticed some issues. So I'm wondering if maybe...
Yeah, get the test. It's a simple test. Get the test, and then they have to look inside. And it can affect females, because I had female cousins with it, and they had to go in there and open up the bladder. Sometimes, for some reason, the bladder neck gets very tightened. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like an obstruction, basically, and then the fluid, the urine builds up.
Mm-hmm.
And so women can get that also. So.
Oh, great. Just add one more thing.
I hope you don't have it, but if you do, it's relatively easy to treat, and you may not have to catheterize yourself. You know, I have to catheterize myself four times a day. And,
okay. And
so if you can avoid that, it's better.
Yeah. Yeah, I prefer to avoid that. I have enough, accompaniments on my body already.
yes. But that's important, because if you don't get it checked out, you can end up with kidney failure because the urine backs up.
Right.
It's so important to empty the bladder and not have that additional condition.
Mm-hmm.
Any luck, Marianne?
No, I'm still looking, and I know because I posted it. Posted it on Twitter and Facebook, and now I can't find it, but I will.
If you do find it after this program, could you email me it? Because I'd like to know for sure.
I had intent of doing that, because I'm trying to listen as I'm doing.
Yeah, it's okay. I was surprised, because I thought they weren't doing studies in the U.S. For that particular drug, because,
Yeah, I thought another company bought the rights to it. And then
maybe it got approved just for the constipation, not for gastroparesis, which would be fine, too, because the doctors could still use it off-label.
I'm pretty sure that's probably the way it happened, but I'm still checking. So if I don't find it during the program, I will definitely email you. Or if anybody else wants to go, just send me a quick email, and I'll send it to you as soon as I find out.
Yeah.
Did anyone ever use Cisapride?
Yes, I was one of the guinea pigs on Cisapride.
Well, it's actually a good drug. It really did work for gastroparesis, but, you know, the few people that – really, that drug, I think you could still get it, and it probably still works to a certain extent. You know,
yeah,
the cardiac side effects. If you have cardiac problems, you definitely shouldn't use it, but
yeah,
I think
you
can still get a hold of it.
You can't get it anymore. I mean, I used to use it for my scleroderma, and you can't get it anywhere. It's not even made anywhere.
Right.
You can get it in Mexico.
Well,
In
yeah.
Mexico.
Yeah, exactly. I was one of the guinea pigs when they came out with Cisapride. I was one of the first pediatric patients that was given it. And timing-wise, it couldn't have come at a better time for me because I was doing really, really poorly at that point. And at that point, they weren't even giving me to age, six. So, that came at a really important junction in my life, and it worked so well for me for a good 6 to 8 months that I actually gained weight and was able to eat, and it did really well, and then it stopped working. But it did work for a while.
Did anyone ever use Sandostatin?
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Sandostatin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know what that drug is.
Yeah.
That's an anti-immune drug, isn't it?
Sandostatin was done in a study back in 1994 at the University of Michigan for people with scleroderma.
Oh.
And it was very effective, but there's only been one study. I haven't seen any follow-up to using sandostatin for motility. I used it for about 6 months. It worked beautifully, and then it blew my gallbladder, which was one of the problems. But I, I never hear anyone talking about sandostatin.
No.
I guess I should get on the internet and see if it's still being used.
Yeah.
They use it in a lot of AIDS patients.
So I would go, but I haven't heard for a while about that. I'm going to have to email to you, George. We are so out of time. I just want to thank everybody for participating or just listening within this program. I say this all the time, but I can only speak from my heart. That's the only way I know how, and that is that you are all my heroes. The stories that I hear, I take with me after this call and throughout every single day of my life. I reflect on it, and really, you people are so determined, so filled with courage. I know you have your moments, but you are such an inspiration to me as well as this organization. Please don't be strangers. Contact us anytime, and we hope to see you during our next pseudo-obstruction program. Reach out to me with questions you may have. God bless you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you,
everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.